insisted. In Copenhagen, there was this club. It's what they call a telephone club. There's all these tables, yar? And every table has a number that's lit up in red lights. If you see someone interesting, someone really hot, sitting at table 12, you just dial up number 12 and speak to them. Fucking deadly system, man. Half the time, you don't know who's calling you, or they don't know who you are. Sometimes you talk for an hour, trying to guess who's talking to you, because everybody is talking at the same time. And then you tell each other what table you're at. I had a real nice party there, I can tell you. But if they tried to do it here, it wouldn't last 5 minutes, because the guys couldn't handle it. So many Indian guys are chutias, yar. They'd be swearing and saying all sorts of indecent shit, the childish motherfuckers. That's all I'm saying. In Copenhagen, the people were a lot cooler, and we've still got a damn long way to go here before India catches up to them on the cool scale.
I think that things are getting better, Ola volunteered. I get the feeling the future of India is a good future. I'm sure things will be good, you know, like better than now, and there will be a lot of better living for a lot of the people.
We all turned to stare at her. The table was silent. We were stunned to hear such sentiments expressed by a young woman who made her living as the sexual plaything of those Indians who were rich enough to exploit her. She was used and abused, and I, for one, would have expected her to be more cynical. Optimism is the first cousin of love, and it's exactly like love in three ways. It's pushy, it has no real sense of humour, and it turns up where you least expect it.
Really, my dear foolish Ola, nothing changes at all, Didier said, curling his lip in disgust. If you want to curdle the milk of your human kindness, or turn your compassion into contempt, get a job as a waitress or a cleaner. The two fastest ways to develop a healthy loathing for the human race and its destiny is to serve it food or clean up after it, on the minimum wage. I have done both jobs in those terrible days when I was forced to work for a living. It was horrible. I shudder now in thinking about it. That's where I learned that nothing ever really changes. And to speak the truth, I am glad of it. In a better world, or a worse one, I would make no money at all.
Bullshit, Letty declared. Things can get better and things can get a lot worse. Ask the people in the slum. They're experts in how much worse things can get. Isn't that right, Carla?
We all turned our attention to Carla. She toyed with her cup for an instant, turning it slowly in the saucer with her long index finger.
I think that we all, each one of us, we all have to earn our future, she said slowly. I think the future is like anything else that's important. It has to be earned. If we don't earn it, we don't have a future at all. And if we don't earn it, if we don't deserve it, we have to live in the present, more or less forever. Or worse, we have to live in the past. I think that's probably what love is. A way of earning the future.
Well, I agree with Didier, Maurizio stated, finishing his meal with a glass of iced water. I like things just as they are, and I am content if they do not change.
How about you?
Carla asked, turning to face me. What about me? I smiled.
If you could be happy, really happy, for just a while, but you knew from the start that it would end in sadness and bring pain afterwards, would you choose to have that happiness, or would you avoid it?
The attention and the question unsettled me, and I felt momentarily uncomfortable in the expectant silence that awaited my reply. I had the feeling that she'd asked the question before, and that it was a kind of test. Maybe she'd already asked the others at the table. Maybe they'd given their answers and were waiting to hear mine. I wasn't sure what she wanted me to say. But the fact was that my life had already answered the question. I'd made my choice when I escaped from prison. I'd choose the happiness, I replied, and was rewarded with a half smile of recognition or amusement, perhaps it was both, from Carla.
I wouldn't do it, Ola said, frowning. I hate sadness. I can't bear it. I would rather have nothing at all than even a little sadness. I think that's why I love to sleep so much now. It's impossible to be really sad when you're asleep. You can be happy and afraid and angry in your dreams. But you have to be wide awake to be sad, don't you think?
I'm with you, Ulla, Vikram agreed. There's too much fucking sadness in the world, yeah. That's why everybody is getting so stoned all the time. I know that's why I'm getting so stoned all the time.
No, I agree with you, Lin, Kavita put in. Although I couldn't be sure how much was agreement with me and how much merely the reflex of opposing Vikram. If you have a chance at real happiness, whatever the cost, you have to take it.
Didier grew restless, irritated with the turn the conversation had taken.
You are being much too serious, all of you.
I'm not,
Vikram objected, stung by the suggestion. Didier fixed him with one raised eyebrow.
I mean that you are making things to be more difficult than they are, or need to be. The facts of life are very simple. In the beginning, we feared everything. Animals, the weather, the trees, the night sky. Everything except each other. Now we fear each other, and almost nothing else. No one knows why anyone does anything. No one tells the truth. No one is happy. No one is safe. In the face of all that is so wrong with the world, the very worst thing you can do is survive. And yet, you must survive. It is this dilemma that makes us believe and cling to the lie that we have a soul, and that there is a God who cares about its fate. And now you have it.
He sat back in his chair and twirled the points of his D'Artagnan moustache with both hands.
I'm not sure what he just said, Vikram muttered after a pause. But somehow I agree with him, and feel insulted at the same time.
Maurizio rose from his seat to leave. He placed a hand on Carla's shoulder and turned to the rest of us with a brilliant smile of affability and charm. I had to admire that smile, even as I was working myself up to hate him for it.
Don't be confused, Vikram, he said pleasantly.
Didier only has one subject, himself.
And his curse, Carla added quickly, is that it is a fascinating subject.
Merci, Carla, darling,
Didier murmured, presenting her with a little bow.
Allora, Modena, let's go. We may see you all later, at the Presidency. Ciao.
He kissed Carla on the cheek, put on his Ray-Ban sunglasses, and stalked out into the crowded night with Modena at his side. The Spaniard hadn't spoken once all evening, or even smiled. As their shapes were lost in the shifting, shuffling figures on the street, however, I saw that he spoke to Maurizio passionately, waving his clenched fist. I watched them until they were gone, and was startled and a little ashamed to hear Letty speak aloud the smallest, meanest corner of my thoughts.
He's not as cool as he looks, she snarled.
No man is as cool as he looks, Carla said, smiling and reaching out to cover Letty's hand with her own.
You don't like Maurizio anymore? Ulla asked.
I hate him. No, I don't hate him, but I despise him. It makes me sick to look at him.
My dear Letitia,
Didier began, but Carla cut him off. Not now, Didier. Give it a rest.
I don't know how I could have been so stupid, Letty growled, clenching her teeth.
No, yeah, Ulla said slowly. I don't want to say I told you so, but...
Oh, why not? Kavita asked. I love to say I told you so. I tell Vikram I told you so at least once a week. I'd rather say I told you so than eat chocolate.
I like the guy, Vikram put in. Did you all know he's a fantastic horseman? He can ride like Clint Eastwood, yeah. I saw him at Chow Party last week, riding on the beach with this gorgeous blonde Swedish chick. He rode just like Clint in High Plains Drifter, I'm telling you, fucking deadly.
Oh, well, he rides a horse, Letty said. How could I have been so wrong about him? I take it all back, then.
He's got a cool hi-fi in his apartment, too, Vikram added, apparently oblivious to Letty's mood. and some damn fine original Italian movie scores.
That's it, I'm off, Letty declared, standing and grabbing her handbag and the book she'd brought with her. Her red hair, falling in gentle curls that framed her face, trembled with her irritation. Her pale skin stretched so flawlessly over the soft curves of her heart-shaped face that for a moment, in the bright white light, she was a furious marble Madonna. And I recalled what Carla had said of her.
I think Letty's the most spiritual of all of us.
Vikram jumped to his feet with her.
I'll walk you to your hotel. I'm going your way.
Is that right?
Letty asked, rounding on him so swiftly that he flinched.
Which way would that be, then?
I'm going kind of everywhere, yeah. I'm taking a very long walk, like, so wherever you're going, I'll be going your way.
Oh, all right, if you must,
she murmured, her teeth clenched and her eyes flashing blue sparks.
Carla, me love, see you at the Taj tomorrow for coffee. I promise not to be late this time.
I'll be there,
Carla agreed.
Well, bye all,
Letty said, waving.
Yeah, me too,
Vikram added, rushing after her.
You know, the thing I like most about Letitia, Didier mused, is that no little bit of her is French. Our culture, the French culture, is so pervasive and influential that almost everyone in the whole world is at least a little bit French. This is especially so for women. Almost every woman in the world is French in some way. But Letitia, she is the most un-French woman I have ever known.
You're full of it, Didier,
Kavita remarked.
Tonight more than most nights. What is it? Did you fall in love or out of love?
He sighed and stared at his hands, folding one on top of the other.
A little of both, I think. I'm feeling very blue. Federico, you know him? Has found religion. It is a terrible business, and it has wounded me, I confess. In truth, his saintliness has broken my heart. But enough of that. Imtiaz Daker has a new exhibition at the Jehangir. Her work is always sensuous and a little bit wild, and it brings me to myself again. Kavita, would you like to see it with me?
Sure, Kavita smiled. I'd be happy to.
I'll walk to the Regal Junction with you,
Ola sighed.
I have to meet Modena.
They rose and said goodbye and walked through the causeway arch, but then Didier returned and stood beside me at the table. Resting a hand on my shoulder as if to steady himself, he smiled down at me with an expression of surprisingly tender affection.
Go with him, Lin, he said. Go with Prabhakar to the village. Every city in the world has a village in its heart. You will never understand the city unless you first understand the village. Go there. When you return, I will see what India has made of you. Bonne chance.
He hurried off, leaving me alone with Carla. When Didier and the others were at the table, the restaurant had been noisy. Suddenly, all was quiet, or it seemed to be, and I had the impression that every word I spoke would be echoed from table to table in the large room.
Are you leaving us?
Carla asked, mercifully speaking first.
Well, Prabhakar invited me to go with him on a trip to his parents' village. His native place, he calls it.
And you're going?
Yes, I think I will. It's something of an honor to be asked, I take it. He told me he goes back to his village to visit his parents once every 6 months or so. He's done that for the last 9 years, since he's been working the tourist beat in Bombay. But I'm the first foreigner he ever invited to go there with him.
She winked at me, the start of a smile tugging at the corners of her mouth.
You may not be the first one he asked. You may be the first one of his tourists crazy enough to actually say yes, but it amounts to the same thing.
Do you think I'm crazy to accept the invitation?
Not at all. Or at least, crazy in the right way, like the rest of us. Where is the village?
I don't know exactly. It's in the north of the state. He told me it takes a train and 2 bus rides to get there.
Didier's right. You have to go. If you want to stay here, in Bombay, as you say,
then you should spend some time in the village. The village is the key. A passing waiter took our last order, and moments later brought a banana lassi for Carla and a chai for me.
How long did it take you to feel comfortable here, Carla? I mean, you always seem so relaxed and at home. It's like you've always been here.
Oh, I don't know. It's the right place for me, if you understand what I mean. And I knew that on the first day, in the first hour that I came here. So, in a sense, I was comfortable from the beginning.
It's funny you say that. I felt a bit like that myself. Within an hour of landing at the airport, I had this incredibly strong feeling that this was the right place for me.
And I suppose that the real breakthrough came with the language. When I started to dream in Hindi, I knew that I was at home here. Everything has fallen into place since then.
Is that it now? Are you going to stay here forever?
There's no such thing as forever, she answered in her slow, deliberate way. I don't know why we use the word.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll stay until I get what I want. And then maybe I'll go somewhere else.
What do you want, Carla? She frowned in concentration and shifted her gaze to stare directly into my eyes. It was an expression I came to know well, and it seemed to say, if you have to ask the question, you have no right to the answer.
I want everything, she replied with a faint, wry smile. You know, I said that once to a friend of mine, and he told me that the real trick in life is to want nothing and to succeed in getting it.
Later, after we'd negotiated the crowds on the causeway and the strand, and walked the leafy arches of the empty streets behind the night-silent Kolaba market, we stopped at a bench beneath a towering elm near her apartment. It's really a paradigm shift, I said, trying to explain a point I'd been making as we'd walked. A completely different way of looking at things, and thinking about things.
You're right. That's exactly what it is.
Prabhakar took me to a kind of hospice, an old apartment building near the St. George Hospital. It was full of sick and dying people who'd been given a piece of floor space to lie down and die on. And the owner of the place, who has this reputation as a kind of saint, was walking around, tagging the people with signs that told how many useful organs they had. It was a huge organ bank, full of living people who pay for the privilege of a quiet, clean place to die, off the street, by providing organs whenever this guy needs them. And the people were pathetically grateful to the guy for it. They revered him. They looked at him as if they loved him.
He put you through it in the last 2 weeks, your friend Prabhakar, didn't he?
Well, there was much worse than that. But the real problem is that you can't do anything. You see kids who, well, they're in a lot of trouble, and you see people in the slums. He took me to the slum, where he lives, and the stink of the open latrine, and the hopeless mess of the place, and the people staring at you from the doorways of their hovels, and you can't change anything. You can't do anything about it. You have to accept that things could be worse, and they'll never be much better. And you're completely helpless in the face of it.
It's good to know what's wrong with the world, Carla said after a while. But it's just as important to know that sometimes, no matter how wrong it is, you can't change it. A lot of the bad stuff in the world wasn't really that bad until someone tried to change it.
I'm not sure I want to believe that. I know you're right. I know we make things worse sometimes, the more we try to make them better. But I want to believe that if we do it right, everything and everyone can change for the better.
You know, I actually ran into Prabhakar today. He told me to ask you about the water, whatever that means.
Oh, yeah, I laughed. Just yesterday, I went down from my hotel to meet Prabhakar on the street, but on the stairwell,
there were these Indian guys, one after the other, carrying big pots of water on their heads and climbing the stairs. I had to stand against the wall to let them pass. When I made it to the bottom, I saw this big wooden barrel with iron-rimmed wheels attached to it. It was a kind of water wagon. Another guy was using a bucket, and he was dipping it into the barrel and filling the big carry pots with water. I watched this for ages, and the men made a lot of trips up and down the stairs. When Prabhakar came along, I asked him what they were doing. He told me that that was the water for my shower, that the shower came from a tank on the roof, and that these men filled the tank with their pots.
Of course.
Yeah, you know that, and I know that now. But yesterday was the first I heard of it. In this heat, I've been in the habit of taking 3 showers a day. I never realized that men had to climb 6 flights of stairs to fill a damn tank so that I could take those showers. I felt horrible about it, you know? I told Prabhakar I'd never take another shower in that hotel again. Not ever.
What did he say?
He said, "No, no, you don't understand." He called it a people job. "It's only because of tourists like me," he explained, "that those men have a job." And he told me that each man is supporting a family of his own from his wages. "You should have 3 showers, 4 showers, even 5 showers every day," he told me. She nodded in agreement. Then he told me to watch the men while they got themselves ready to run through the city again, pushing their water wagon. And I think I knew what he meant, what he wanted me to see. They were strong, those guys. They were strong and proud and healthy. They weren't begging or stealing. They were working hard to earn their way, and they were proud of it. When they ran off into the traffic, with their strong muscles and getting a few sly looks from some of the young Indian girls, I saw that their heads were up and their eyes straight ahead.
"And you still take a shower in the hotel?"
3 a day, I laughed. "Tell me, why was Letty so upset with Maurizio?" She looked at me, staring hard into my eyes for the second time that evening.
"Letty has a pretty good contact at the Foreigner Registration Branch. He's a senior police official who has an obsession with sapphire gems, and Letty supplies them to him at the wholesale rate, or a little below. Sometimes, in exchange for this favor, she can arrange to have a visa renewed almost indefinitely. Maurizio wanted to extend his visa for another year. He allowed Letty to think he was in love with her. Well, you can say he seduced her. And when he got what he wanted, he dumped her."
"Letty's your friend."
"I warned her. Maurizio is not a man to love. You can do everything else with him, but not love him. She didn't listen to me."
"You still like Maurizio, even after he did that to your friend?"
"Maurizio did exactly what I knew he would do. In his own mind, he made a trade of his affection for the visa, and it was a fair trade. He would never try anything like that with me."
"Is he afraid of you?" I asked, smiling.
"Yes, I think he is a little bit. That's one of the reasons I like him. I could never respect a man who didn't have the good sense to be at least a little bit afraid of me."
She stood up, and I rose with her. Under the street lamp, her green eyes were jewels of desire, wet with light. Her lips widened in a half-smile that was mine, a moment that was mine alone, and the beggar, my heart, began to hope and plead.
"Tomorrow," she said, "when you go to Prabhakar's village, try to relax completely and go with the experience. Just let yourself go. Sometimes in India, you have to surrender before you win."
"You've always got some wise advice, haven't you?" I said, laughing gently.
"That's not wise, Lynn. I think wisdom is very overrated. Wisdom is just cleverness with all the guts kicked out of it. I'd rather be clever than wise,
any day. Most of the wise people I know give me a headache, but I never met a clever man or woman I didn't like. If I was giving wise advice, which I'm not, I'd say, don't get drunk, don't spend all your money, and don't fall in love with a pretty village girl. That would be wise. That's the difference between clever and wise. I prefer to be clever. And that's why I told you to surrender when you get to the village, no matter what you find when you get there. Okay, I'm going. Come and see me when you get back. I look forward to it. I really do. She kissed my cheek and turned away. I couldn't obey the impulse to hold her in my arms and kiss her lips. I watched her walk, her dark silhouette a part of the night itself. Then she moved into the warm yellow light near the door of her apartment, and it was as if my watching eyes had made her shadow come to life, as if my heart alone had painted her from darkness with the light and colours of love. She turned once to see that I was watching her, before she softly closed and locked the door. That last hour with her was a Borsellino test, I was sure. And all the walking way back to the hotel, I asked myself if I'd passed it, or if I'd failed. I still think about it, all these years later. I still don't know.
Chapter 5. The long, flat interstate platforms at Victoria Terminus train station stretched out to vanishing points beneath a metal heaven of rolling vaulted ceilings. The cherubs of that architectural sky were pigeons, so far overhead in their flutter from roost to roost that they were only faintly discernible, distant celestial beings of flight and white light. The great station, those who used it every day knew it as VT, was justly famous for the splendour of its intricately detailed facades, towers, and exterior ornaments. But its most sublime beauty, it seemed to me, was found in its cathedral interiors. There, the limitations of function met the ambitions of art, as the timetable and the timeless commanded equal respect. For a long hour, I sat on and amid our pile of luggage at the street end of the northbound interstate platform. It was 6 o'clock in the evening, and the station was filled with people, luggage, bundles of goods, and an agricultural assortment of live and recently deceased animals. Prabhaka ran into the crowds, milling between two stationary trains. It was the fifth time I'd watched him leave. And then, a few minutes later, for the fifth time, I watched him run back.
For God's sake, sit down, Prabhu. Can't be sitting, Lin. Well, let's get on the train, then. Can't be getting on also, Lin. It is not now the time for getting on the train.
So, when will it be the time for getting on the train?
I think a little bit almost quite very soon, and not long. Listen, listen.
There was an announcement. It might have been in English. It was the kind of sound an angry drunk makes, amplified through the unique distortions of many ancient cone-shaped speakers. As he listened to it, Prabhaka's face moved from apprehension to anguish.
No, no, Lin, quickly, we must hurry, you must hurry.
Hang on, hang on. You've had me sitting here like a brass Buddha for an hour. Now all of a sudden there's a big rush, and I have to hurry?
Yes, Baba. No time for making Buddha. Beg of pardons to the Holy One. You must make a big rush. He's coming. You must be ready. He's coming.
Who's coming? Prabhaka turned to look along the platform. The announcement, whatever it was, had galvanized the crowds of people, and they rushed at two stationary trains, hurling themselves and their bundles into the doors and windows. From the broiling tangle of bodies, one man emerged and walked towards us. He was a huge man, one of the biggest men I'd ever seen. He was 2 meters tall, well-muscled, and had a long, thick beard that settled on his burly chest. He wore the Bombay train porter's uniform of cap, shirt and shorts in rough red and khaki linen.
Him,
Prabhaka said, staring at the giant with admiration and dread.
You go with this man now, Lin.
Having long experience with foreigners, the porter took control of the situation. He reached out with both hands. I thought that he wanted to shake hands, so I extended my own in return. He brushed it aside with a look that left me in no doubt as to how repulsive he'd found the gesture. Then, putting his hands under my armpits, he lifted me up and dropped me out of the way to one side of the luggage. It's a disconcerting, albeit exhilarating, experience. When you weigh 90 kilos yourself, to be lifted up so effortlessly by another man. I determined there and then to cooperate with the porter insofar as it was decently possible. While the big man lifted my heavy backpack onto his head and gathered up the rest of the bags, Prabhakar put me at his back and seized a handful of the man's red linen shirt.
"Here, Lin, take it a hold on this shirt," he instructed me. "Hold it and never let it go, this shirt. Tell me your deep and special promise. You will never let it go, these shirts."
His expression was so unusually grave and earnest that I nodded in agreement and took hold of the porter's shirt.
"No, say it also, Lin. Say the words. I will never let it go, these shirts. Quickly."
"Oh, for God's sake. All right. I will never let it go, these shirts. Are you satisfied?"
"Goodbye, Lin,"
Prabhakar shouted, running off into the mill and tumble of the crowd.
"What?
What? Where are you going? Prabhu! Prabhu!"
"Okay, we go now,"
the porter rumbled and roared, in a voice that he'd found in a bear's cave and cured in the barrel of a rusted cannon. He walked off into the crowd, dragging me behind him and kicking outwards by raising his thick knees high with every step. Men scattered before him. When they didn't scatter, they were knocked aside. Bellowing threats, insults, and curses, he thumped a path through the choking throng. Men fell and were pushed aside with every lift and thrust of his powerful legs. In the centre of the crowd, the din was so loud that I could feel it drumming on my skin. People shouted and screamed as if they were the victims of a terrible disaster. Garbled, indecipherable announcements blared from the loudspeakers over our heads. Sirens, bells and whistles wailed constantly. We reached a carriage that was, like all the others, filled to its capacity with a solid wall of bodies in the doorway. It was a seemingly impenetrable human barrier of legs and backs and heads. Astonished and not a little ashamed, I clung to the porter as he hammered his way into the carriage with his indefatigable and irresistible knees. His relentless forward progress stopped at one point in the centre of the carriage. I assumed that the density of the crowd had halted even that juggernaut of a man. I clung to the shirt, determined not to lose my grip on him when he started to move again. In all the furious noise of the cloying press of bodies, I became aware of one word, repeated in an insistent and tormented mantra.
"Sir! Sir! 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 Sir!"
I realized at last that the voice was my own porter's. The word he was repeating with such distress was unrecognizable to me because I wasn't used to being addressed by it. Sir.
"Sir! Sir! Sir! Sir!"
he shouted. I let go of his shirt and looked around to find Prabhakar stretched to his full length along an entire bench seat. He'd fought his way ahead of us into the carriage to reserve a seat, and he was guarding it with his body. His feet were wrapped around the aisle armrest. His hands clasped the armrest at the window end. Half a dozen men had crammed themselves into that part of the carriage, and each tried with unstinting vigour and violence to remove him from the seat. They pulled his hair, punched his body, kicked him, and slapped at his face. He was helpless under the onslaught. But when his eyes met mine, a triumphant smile shone through his grimaces of pain. Incensed, I shoved the men out of the way, grabbing them by shirt collars and hurling them aside with the strength that swarms into the arms of righteous anger. Prabhakar swung his feet to the floor, and I sat down beside him. A brawl started at once for the remaining space on the seat. The porter dumped the luggage at our feet. His face and hair and shirt were wet with sweat. He gave Prabhakar a nod, communicating his respect. It was fully equal, his glaring eyes left no doubt, to the derision he felt for me. Then he shoved his way through the crowd, roaring insults all the way to the door.
"How much did you pay that guy?"
40 rupees, Lin.
40 rupees. The man had battled his way into the carriage with all of our luggage for $2 American.
40 rupees?
Yes, Lin, Prabhakar sighed. It is very expensive, but such good news are very expensive. He has famous knees, that fellow. A lot of guides were making competition for his two knees, but I convinced him to help us, because I told him you were... I am not sure how to say it in English. I told him you were not completely right on your head.
Mentally retarded. You told him I was mentally retarded.
No, he frowned, considering the options. I think that stupid is more of the correct word.
Let me get this straight. You told him I was stupid, and that's why he agreed to help us.
Yes, he grinned. But not just a little of stupid. I told him you were very, 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 very...
All right, I get it.
So the price was 20 rupees for each knees, and now we have it, this good seat.
Are you all right? I asked, angry that he'd allowed himself to be hurt for my sake.
Yes, Baba. A few bruises I will have on all my bodies, but nothing is broken.
Well, what the hell did you think you were doing? I gave you money for the tickets. We could have sat down in first or second class like civilized people. What are we doing back here? He looked at me, reproach and disappointment brimming in his large, soft brown eyes. He pulled a small bundle of notes from his pockets and handed it to me.
This is the change from the tickets money. Anybody can buy first class tickets, Lin. If you want to buy tickets in first class, you can be doing that all on yourself only. You don't need a Bombay guide to buy tickets in comfortable empty carriages. But you need a very excellent Bombay guide like me, like Prabhakar Kishan Kare, to get into this carriage at VT station and get a good seat, isn't it? This is my job.
Of course it is, I softened, still angry with him because I still felt guilty. But please, for the rest of this trip, don't get yourself beaten up just so that I can have a goddamn seat, okay? He reflected for a moment with a frown of concentration, and then brightened again, his familiar smile refulgent in the dimly lit carriage.
If it is absolutely must be a beating,
he said firmly and amiably negotiating the terms of his employment,
I will shout even more loudly, and you can rescue my bruises in the nick of time. Have you a deal?
We are, I sighed, and the train suddenly lurched forward and began to grind its way out of the terminus. In the instant that the train started on its journey, the gouging, biting and brawling ceased completely and were replaced by a studied and genteel courtesy that persisted throughout the entire journey. A man opposite me shifted his feet, accidentally brushing his foot against mine. It was a gentle touch, barely noticeable, but the man immediately reached out to touch my knee and then his own chest with the fingertips of his right hand, in the Indian gesture of apology for an unintended offence. In the carriage and the corridor beyond, the other passengers were similarly respectful, sharing, and solicitous with one another. At first, on that first journey out of the city into India, I found such sudden politeness infuriating after the violent scramble to board the train. It seemed hypocritical for them to show such deferential concern over a nudge with a foot, when minutes before they'd all but pushed one another out of the windows. Now, long years and many journeys after that first ride on a crowded rural train, I know that the scrambled fighting and courteous deference were both expressions of the one philosophy, the doctrine of necessity. The amount of force and violence necessary to board the train, for example, was no less and no more than the amount of politeness and consideration necessary to ensure that the cramped journey was as pleasant as possible afterwards. What is necessary? That was the unspoken but implied and unavoidable question everywhere in India. When I understood that, a great many of the characteristically perplexing aspects of public life became comprehensible. From the acceptance of sprawling slums by city authorities, to the freedom that cows had to roam at random in the midst of traffic, from the toleration of beggars on the streets to the concatenate complexity of the bureaucracies, and from the gorgeous, unashamed escapism of Bollywood movies to the accommodation of hundreds of thousands of refugees from Tibet, Iran, Afghanistan, Africa, and Bangladesh, in a country that was already too crowded with sorrows and needs of its own. The real hypocrisy, I came to realize, was in the eyes and minds and criticisms of those who came from lands of plenty, where no one had to fight for a seat on a train. Even on that first train ride, I knew in my heart that Didier had been right when he'd compared India and its billion souls to France. I had an intuition, echoing his thought, that if there were a billion Frenchmen or Australians or Americans living in such a small space, the fighting to board the train would be much more, and the courtesy afterwards much less. And in truth, the politeness and consideration shown by the peasant farmers, travelling salesmen, itinerant workers, and returning sons and fathers and husbands did make for an agreeable journey, despite the cramped conditions and relentlessly increasing heat. Every available centimetre of seating space was occupied, even to the sturdy metal luggage racks over our heads. The men in the corridor took turns to sit or squat on a section of floor that had been set aside and cleaned for the purpose. Every man felt the press of at least two other bodies against his own. Yet there wasn't a single display of grouchiness or bad temper. However, when I surrendered my seat for 4 hours of the journey to an elderly man with a shock of white hair and spectacles as thick as the lenses on an army scout's binoculars, Prabhakar was provoked to an indignant exasperation.
"So hard I fought with nice peoples for your seat, Lin. Now you give it up, like a spit of pan juices, and stand up in the passage, and on your legs also."
"Come on, Prabhu, he's an old guy. I can't let him stand while I sit."
"That is easy. Only you don't look at that old fellow, Lin. If he is standing, don't look at him standing. That is his business only, that standing, and nothing for your seat."
"It's the way I am," I insisted, laughing self-consciously in the conversation he was directing across the whole carriage of interested fellow passengers.
"Such scratches and bruises I have it on my body, Lin," he whined,
talking to me but appealing to the curious gallery. He lifted his shirt and singlet to display what was indeed a rough scratch and gathering bruise.
"For this old fellow to put the left side buttocks on the seat, I have these many scratches and bruises. For his right side buttocks, I have more bruises on my other side also. For him to put his two side buttocks on the seat, I am all bruising and scratching on my bodies. This is a very shame, Lin. That is all I'm telling you. It is a very shame."
He drifted between English and Hindi until all of us knew the substance of his complaint. Every one of my fellow passengers looked at me with frowns or headshakes of disapproval. The fiercest glance of reproof, of course, came from the elderly man for whom I'd surrendered my seat. He glared at me malevolently during the entire 4 hours. When at last he rose to leave and I resumed my seat, he muttered such a vile curse that the other passengers sputtered into guffaws of laughter, and a couple of them commiserated with me by patting my shoulder and back. Through the sleepy night and into the rose-petal dawn, the train rattled on. I watched and listened, literally rubbing shoulders with the people of the interior towns and villages. And I learned more during those 14 constricted and largely silent hours in the crowded economy class section, communicating without language, than I could have learned in a month of travelling first class. No discovery pleased me more on that first excursion from the city than the full translation of the famous Indian head wiggle. The weeks I'd spent in Bombay with Prabhakar had taught me that the shaking or wiggling of the head from side to side, that most characteristic of Indian expressive gestures, was the equivalent of a forward nod of the head, meaning yes. I'd also discerned the subtler senses of I agree with you and yes, I would like that. What I learned on the train was that a universal message attached to the gesture when it was used as a greeting, which made it uniquely useful. Most of those who entered the open carriage greeted the other seated or standing men with a little wiggle of the head. The gesture always drew a reciprocal wag of the head from at least one and sometimes several of the passengers. I watched it happen at station after station, knowing that the newcomers couldn't be indicating yes or I agree with you with the head wiggle, because nothing had been said. And there was no exchange other than the gesture itself. Gradually, I realized that the wiggle of the head was a signal to the others that carried an amiable and disarming message. I'm a peaceful man. I don't mean any harm. Moved by admiration and no small envy for the marvelous gesture, I resolved to try it myself. The train stopped at a small rural station. A stranger joined our group in the carriage. When our eyes met for the first time, I gave the little wiggle of my head and a smile. The result was astounding. The man beamed a smile at me so huge that it was half the brilliance of Prabhaka's own, and set to such energetic head-waggling in return that I was at first a little alarmed. By journey's end, however, I'd had enough practice to perform the movement as casually as others in the carriage did, and to convey the gentle message of the gesture. It was the first truly Indian expression my body learned, and it was the beginning of a transformation that has ruled my life, in all the long years since that journey of crowded hearts. We left the railway at Jalgaon, a regional centre that boasted wide streets of commerce and bustle. It was 9 o'clock, and the morning rush was in rumble, roll, rattle and swing. Raw materials, iron, glass, wood, textiles and plastic, were being unloaded from the train as we left the station. A range of products, from pottery to clothing to hand-woven tatami mats, was arriving at the station for dispatch to the cities. The aroma of fresh, highly spiced food stirred my appetite, but Prabhaka urged me on to the bus terminal. In fact, the terminal was simply a vast open patch of rough ground that served as a staging area for dozens of long-distance coaches. We drifted from bus to bus for half an hour, carrying our bulky luggage. I couldn't read the Hindi and Marathi texts on the front and side of each bus. Prabhaka could read the signs, but still he felt it necessary to ask every driver about his destination. "Doesn't it tell you where every bus is going on the front of the bus?" I demanded, irritated by the delay.
"Yes, Lin. See, this one says Aurangabad, and that one says Ajanta, and that one says Chalisgaon, and that one says..."
Yeah, so why do we have to ask every driver where he's going?"
"Oh," he exclaimed, genuinely surprised by the question. "Because not every sign is a truly sign."
"What do you mean, not a truly sign?" He stopped, putting down his share of the luggage, and offered me a smile of indulgent patience.
"Well, Lin, you see, some of those driving fellows are going to places that is nobody wants to go to. Little places they are, with a few people only. So they put a sign for more popular place."
"You're telling me that they put a sign up saying they're going to a big town where lots of people want to go, but they're really going somewhere else where nobody wants to go?"
"That's right, Lin," he beamed.
"Why?"
"You see, because those people who come to them to go to the popular place, well, maybe the driver can convince them to go to the not popular place. It's for business, Lin. It's a business thing."
"That's crazy," I said, exasperated.
"You must have it a bit of sympathies for these fellows, Lin. If they put the truly sign on their bus, no one will talk to them in the whole day, and they will be very lonely."
"Oh, well, now I understand," I muttered sarcastically. "We wouldn't want them to feel lonely."
"I know, Lin," Prabhaka smiled. "You have a very good hearts in your bodies."
When at last we did board a bus, it seemed that ours was one of the popular destinations. The driver and his assistant interrogated the passengers to determine precisely where each man or woman intended to set down before allowing them to enter the bus. Those travelling the furthest were then directed to fill the rear seats. The rapidly accumulating piles of luggage, children and livestock filled the aisle to shoulder height, and eventually three passengers crowded into every seat designed for two. Because I had an aisle seat, I was required to take my turn at passing various items, from bundles to babies, backwards over the loaded aisle. The young farmer who passed the first item to me hesitated for a moment, staring into my grey eyes. When I wiggled my head from side to side and smiled, he grinned in return and handed the bundle to me. By the time the bus rolled out of the busy terminal, I was accepting smiles and head wiggles from every man in sight, and waggling and wiggling at them in return. The sign behind the driver's head, in large red letters in Marathi and English, said that the bus was strictly licensed to seat 48 passengers. No one seemed concerned that we were 70 passengers and 2 or 3 tons of cargo. The old Bedford bus swayed on its exhausted springs like a tugboat in a storm tide. Creaks and groans and squeaks issued from the top, sides and floor of the bus, and the brakes squealed alarmingly with every application. Nevertheless, when the bus left the city limits, the driver managed to crank it up to 80 or 90 kilometres per hour. Given the narrow road, the precipitous fall on the low side, the frequent columns of people and animals that lined the high side, the titanic mass of our swaying arc of a bus, and the vertiginous hostility with which the driver negotiated every curve, the speed was sufficient to relieve me of the need to sleep or relax on the ride. During the following 3 hours of that perilous acceleration, we rose to the peak of a ridge of mountains marking the edge of a vast plateau, known as the Deccan, and descended once more to fertile plains within the rim of the plateau. With prayers of gratitude and a new appreciation for the fragile gift of life, we left that first bus at a small, dusty, deserted stop that was marked only by a tattered flag flapping from the branch of a slender tree. Within an hour, a second bus stopped.
"Gora kau hai?"
the driver asked when we climbed aboard the step.
"Who's the white guy?"
"Maza mitra ahi,"
Prabhaka answered with contrived nonchalance, trying in vain to disguise his pride.
"He's my friend."
The exchange was in Marathi, the language of Maharashtra state, which has Bombay as its capital. I didn't understand much of it then, but the same questions and answers were repeated so often during those village months that I learned most of the phrases, with some variations, by heart.
"What's he doing here?"
"He's visiting my family."
"Where's he from?"
"New Zealand,"
Prabhaka replied.
"New Zealand?"
"Yes, New Zealand, in Europe."
"Plenty of money in New Zealand."
"Yes, yes, plenty. They're all rich white people there."
"Does he speak Marathi?"
"No."
"Hindi?"
"No, only English."
"Only English?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"They don't speak Hindi in his country."
"They don't speak Hindi there?"
"No."
"No Marathi? No Hindi?"
"No, only English."
"Holy father, the poor fool."
"Yes."
"How old is he?"
30.
"He looks older."
"They all do. All the Europeans look older and angrier than they really are. It's a white thing."
"Is he married?"
"No."
"Not married? 30 and not married? What's wrong with him?"
"He's European. A lot of them get married only when they're old."
"Oh, that's crazy."
"Yes."
"What job does he do?"
"He is a teacher."
"Teacher is good."
"Yes."
"Does he have a mother and a father?"
"Yes."
"Where are they?"
"In his native place, New Zealand."
"Why isn't he with them?"
"He's traveling. He's looking at the whole world."
"Why?"
"Europeans do that. They work for a while, then they travel around lonely for a while, with no family, until they get old, and then they get married and become very serious."
"That's crazy."
"Yes."
"He must be lonely without his mummy and his daddy, and with no wife and children."
"Yes, but the Europeans don't mind. They get a lot of practice being lonely."
"He has a big, strong body."
"Yes."
"A very strong body."
"Yes."
"Make sure you feed him properly and give him plenty of milk."
"Yes."
"Buffalo milk."
"Yes, yes."
"Make sure he doesn't learn any bad words. Don't teach him any swearing. There are plenty of assholes and bastards around who will teach him the wrong sister fucking words. Keep him away from motherfuckers like that."
"I will."
"And don't let anyone take advantage of him. He doesn't look too bright. Keep an eye on him."
"He's brighter than he looks, but yes, I will look after him."
It troubled none of the other passengers on the bus that the conversation of several minutes had taken place before we could board the bus and move off. The driver and Prabhaka had made sure to speak at a volume adequate to the task of including everyone in the bus. Indeed, once we were underway, the driver sought to include even those outside the bus in the novelty of the experience. Whenever he spied men and women strolling on the road, he sounded the horn to draw their attention, gesticulated with his thumb to indicate the foreigner in the rear of the bus, and slowed to a crawl, so that each pedestrian could examine me with satisfactory thoroughness. With such democratic rationing of the astounding new attraction, the journey of 1 hour took closer to 2, and we arrived at the dusty road to Sunda village in the late afternoon. The bus groaned and heaved away, leaving us in a silence so profound that the breeze against my ears was like a child's sleepy whisper. We'd passed countless fields of maize and banana groves in the last hour of the bus ride, and then on foot we trudged along the dirt road between endless rows of millet plants. Almost fully grown, the plants were well over head height, and in a few minutes of the walk we were deep within a thick-walled labyrinth. The wide sky shrank to a small arc of blue, and the way ahead or behind us dissolved into curves of green and gold, like curtains drawn across the living stage of the world. I'd been preoccupied for some time, nagged by something that it seemed I should have known or realized. The thought, half submerged, troubled me for the best part of an hour, before it swam into the field of vision of my mind's eye. No telegraph poles. No power poles. For most of that hour, I'd seen no sign of electric power, not even distant power lines. Is there electricity in your village?
Oh, no, Prabhaka grinned.
No electricity?
No, none.
There was silence for a time, as I slowly turned off all the appliances I'd come to regard as essential. No electric light, no electric kettle, no television, no hi-fi, no radio, no music. I didn't even have a Walkman with me. How would I live without music?
What am I going to do without music?
I asked, aware of how pathetic I sounded, but unable to suppress the whine of disappointment in my voice.
There will be music full, Baba, he answered cheerfully. I will sing. Everybody will sing. We will sing and sing and sing.
Ah, well, now I feel all right.
And you will sing too, Lin.
Don't count on it, Prabhu.
In the village, everybody sings,
he said with sudden seriousness.
Uh-huh. Yes, everybody.
Let's cross that bridge and chorus when we come to it. How much further is it to the village?
Oh, just a little bit, almost not too very far. And you know, now we have water in our village also.
What do you mean, now you have water?
What I mean is, there's one tap in the village now.
One tap for the whole village?
Yes, and the water is coming out of it for 1 whole hour at 2 o'clock in every afternoon.
1 whole hour per day?
Oh, yes. Well, on most days. Some days it is only coming for 1/2 hour. Some days it is not coming out at all. And then we go back and scrape the green stuff off the top of the water in the well, and we are no problem for water. Ah, look! Here is my father.
Ahead of us, on the rambling and weedy path, was an ox cart. The ox, a huge curve-horned beast, the colour of cafe latte, was shackled to a tall, basket-shaped cart, mounted on 2 wooden steel-rimmed wheels. The wheels were narrow but high, reaching to my shoulder. Smoking a beady cigarette, and sitting on the oxbow yoke, his legs dangling free, was Prabhaka's father. Kishan Mangokare was a tiny man, shorter even than Prabhaka, with very close-cropped grey hair, a short grey moustache, and a prominent paunch on his otherwise slender frame. He wore the white cap, cotton kurta shirt, and dhoti of the farmer caste. The dhoti is technically described as a loincloth, but the term robs the garment of its serene and graceful elegance. It can be gathered up to become work shorts for labour in the fields, or loosened to become pantaloon-style trousers with the ankles free. The dhoti itself is always moving, and it follows the human contour in every act, from running to sitting still. It captures every breeze at noon and keeps out the dawn chill. It's modest and practical, yet flattering and attractive at the same time. Gandhi gave the dhoti prominence on his trips to Europe, in the struggle for Indian independence from England. With all due respect to the Mahatma, however, it's not until